The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
From 1910 to 1997, Black Americans have lost 90% of farmland to air property. You know, the Department of Agriculture has deemed it the worst problem that you've never heard of. So I want people to understand how much of a problem that is, especially for those who own air property, who have air property or is a legal heir or descendant of someone that has it.
My name is Tanae Frazier, and I'm the newest host of The Hearing. I am a senior specialist legal editor with Thomson Reuters Practical Law, and I really love meeting new people, learning their stories, and learning how they're impacting the legal community. Today, I'll be talking to Tara Shelton Harris. She is a renowned writer, librarian, photographer, and world traveler. She has also written two books, which are One Summer in Savannah and Long After We Are Gone. In this episode, she's going to enlighten us on the legal concept of air property. And this is a little known legal concept that affects so many people, and not only just affects them, but has detrimental effects, especially to people of color. We're also going to get into her own personal life and what was her path to becoming an author.
The Hearing.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Tara. But before we get started talking more about your illustrious career and your newest book, Long After We're Gone, I wanted to start off by talking about your journey to becoming an author. Have you always had a passion for writing? And if so, what does that stem from?
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. I'm honored. I've been writing since as long as I can remember, to be honest with you. My first journey into writing started in the sixth grade. I had an amazing teacher, and this is how a lot of the creatives, you go back to their starts, and most of the time they started with that one teacher that inspired them. And mine, her name was Julie Cook. And back then, I'm dating myself, but back then there was a program in school called DEAR, Drop Everything and Read. But she allowed me to drop everything and write. And so during that time when everyone was reading, I was writing because I was that kid that had read just about every book that she can get her hands on. And so I was writing then. And I wrote this story about my class. And she saw me writing and she came over to me and she said, "Do you want to read your story to the class?" And I thought, "No way, I can't read this. It's about them. Like, I can't read this about them." And so it took her most of the year to convince me to stand up in front of the class and read this story. And when I did, they laughed at the jokes, you know, they gasped, they had reactions. And that was the first time that I had saw what the power of writing could do, how I could move someone through my words. And I was hooked after that.
That's so inspiring, because I often hear writers say, you know, even as a child, I knew I wanted to write or I had a passion for writing. Now, since you had a passion for writing and your teacher kind of inspired that, did you always know that you wanted to write a book? You know, how did you move from knowing to actually doing?
No, I did not know I wanted to write a book. I knew I wanted to be a writer. And at the time, I thought I wanted to be a newspaper writer. So when I left high school and went to college, I was going to be this next great newspaper investigative writer. But by the time I got to college, newspapers were starting its decline. And so these newsrooms that I grew up watching on TV and knowing about has started to thin out some. So, and then this is great thing called the internet that came about. And so I knew that newspaper writing wasn't really going to be that area for me, that it was not going to have the longevity. And I'm looking at it now and I'm thinking, wow, there's barely newspapers anymore. And so I started doing freelance writing for trade publications and consumer publications, and just doing freelance for a long time. And I thought one day I would write a book, but it was never that first thing that I gravitated to, because I didn't know anything about it. You know, I did not know that, you know, we didn't have the internet. We couldn't look up how do you write a book or how do you get a book published. It was not easily accessible. And so I just never thought about it until the internet came along. And then I started being curious about how people were getting their books published. And so it took years, right? I had already had 10, 15 years of working as a freelance writer before I finally said, you know what? Okay, I'm going to write a book now.
So as you were working as a freelance writer, tell me some of the things that you worked on exactly. And who were some of the people that actually inspired you when you were navigating from you wanted to be a newspaper writer or a journalist and a reporter, who were some of the people that inspired you in that as well?
Gosh, I don't think I had any major ones, just because I grew up and I went to college in a small area. Well, it's not small. It's University of Arkansas is where I went to college. But we didn't really have a lot of those newspapers around to be inspired and to like one particular like newspaper writer. And so when I was halfway finished with Arkansas, the internet, as I said, was starting to come up, and there was an opportunity that I could leave college and go update travel guidebooks in Europe. As a matter of fact, more specifically, Slovenia and Croatia. And so they were, this one particular publication that did travel books was like, we need people to go and update these books and make sure that the hotel address is correct, make sure they have number of rooms. And so I thought I could go do that. And I just knew that my mother was not going to let me do this. I was in the middle of college. I was a sophomore in college, and I was going to leave college to go do this. And she said, go. She said, do it. You know, I was very surprised at that because my mother's just super educated. You have to have your degrees, you know, woman. And she said, go do this. And then when you come back, you can always go to college, which I did. I did eventually come back and get my degrees. But that's what I did for a long time. I traveled throughout Europe.
That's remarkable. And what's even more remarkable is that when your mother, she saw this opportunity for you and she said, go, you know, go do it. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, my mother is a trailblazer. She mm-hmm. is very much a trailblazer type of a woman. And she just said, promise me you come back. And when you finish doing this and you get that out of your system and whatever, promise me you come back and get your degree. And I made her that promise, and I did. But I did that for almost 10 years. Like, that was a 10-year journey for me. Yeah.
Do you feel like having had that experience in Europe and traveling and seeing the world impacted your writing style?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's impacted me as a person just mm-hmm. because I just have so much more perspective than I think the people that have not done it. I have a lot of empathy. I not only travel to Europe, but I've been to Southeast Asia. I've been to a lot of third world countries. And just being able to see the differences in between how our government governs and other government governs, how other people live, how other mm-hmm. people, the things they do and their attitudes, has really helped me as far as my writing whenever I'm starting to put characters together and put situations and things together. It kind of helps me be able to go back and say, okay, I have this perspective. And so, yes, travel has definitely influenced my writing.
Now, Tara, you've been a librarian, I want to say, for over 15 years.
Mm-hmm, I have.
So how did you transition from being a freelance writer to now becoming a librarian?
My husband. So, I mean, if I was not married, I'd probably still be somewhat of a, you know, person that's traveling around a lot. Mm-hmm. I would be that person. But I met my husband, and actually we were college sweethearts. So we knew each other in college, and after college and after I was doing all this, and we decided to, okay, let's do this. And so I came off the road and stopped traveling, and I got married, and I was still working as a freelance writer. Mm-hmm. And just wanted something else to do in between working as a freelance and a freelance writer. So I saw that my small little local library had a position open for a page. Now, library page, they're phasing them out of the library world now, but library pages are people who just, their job is just to put the books on the shelf. And I thought, I can do that. I needed something to just be able to go home and be able to write. So I didn't need anything that was going to be too mentally taxing for me, so I can go home and write these articles. And so I was like, I can put books up. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I could do that. And so I started doing that, and that lasted about 6 months. And my director at the time was like, there's a full-time position that's coming available. Do you want it? And I thought I could do both of these at the same time. And then I just fell in love with librarianship. Librarianship is one of those professions that is a second career for a lot of people. And I can see why, just because you fall in love with serving people and helping people. And then what slowly started to happen is I started focusing more on library work than less on my writing, because in the middle of that, we had a recession, mm-hmm. a really bad recession, the 2008-2007 recession. And so I lost a lot of my freelance contacts. They just could not afford to pay me the money because the advertising dollars went down. And mm-hmm. so then I was stuck after a while. I was working at the library, but when you're called to write and to be a writer, it doesn't go away because you're doing other things. Yeah. And so I was still writing, but I still had that buzz. And that's when I was working at the library, when I said, okay, I'm going to try my hand and write a book.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I like when you said that you had that call. It doesn't go away. Mm. I mean, was it like a unction, a pushing to write your first novel? Like, how did that feel?
Yeah, it's a spiritual calling for me. God speaks to me. He leads my life. And it's something that he put into me when I was very young. I mean, he said, okay, you're going to be a writer and you can do all these other things. But as long as you come back to writing, this is where you're supposed to be. And a lot of my freelance contacts had dried up and I had more time. I was still working at the library, but I had a lot more time now. And so I said, okay, I'm going to try my hand in writing a book. And so I did. I came up with this idea and I wrote this book and I thought, okay, I did it. And I was so proud of myself because writing a book is not easy. It's not easy. And I thought, okay, I did it. So let's try to get it published. And I tried to get it published and it didn't work out. I mean, for so many different reasons why it did not work out. And I was so disappointed. I tried to get an agent for it. I couldn't get an agent. I couldn't get it published. And back then, self-publishing wasn't really, it was starting to come on. People were just now starting to self-publish their books. It's not anything like it is today. Mm-hmm. And I was very disappointed because everything in my life, when I put hard work toward it, there was always a rainbow. There was always that goal at the end of the rainbow. Like you work really hard and the payoff is this, what you want. And it was the first time that payoff did not pay off for me. And I did not know how to process that just because this was supposed to happen the way I wanted it to and it did not. And so it kind of hurt my feelings, you know, for a long time because writing had always been my escape and that thing that I did. And this is something that I had failed at in my eyes at the time. I thought that I had failed at this. But what I didn't realize and I realize now is I needed to write that book to show myself that I could write the book. Because as I said, writing a book is not easy. It takes so much discipline. I talk to so many people today who say, I want to write a book. You know, how do I write a book? And I say, just write it. Write the book first. You have to tell yourself, you know, that you can do this. I talk to people who get three chapters in. Three chapters, I think, is the standard, how far people get and they stop. It's just because it's really hard. And so I needed to write that book to show myself that I had the discipline to write a book, but also to learn about the publishing and the industry itself, just because I thought, here's a book, somebody's going to publish it, and I'm going to be on Oprah, sitting on Oprah's couch, talking about my next book. And the truth is, publishing is really hard. I mean, to simplify it, it's very hard. And so I kind of got a wake-up call, you know, after that first book.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was your first book, it wasn't One Summer in Savannah, was it something different?
Okay. It was something completely different. And I call that book my practice book. Okay. People ask me, will you ever try to get it published? And I said, no, because it did its purpose. That book exists because the purpose of it was for me to write it, for no other reason for that. You know, and I realized then that not everything you do has to equal something that you think, that it can have these hidden meanings behind it. And it was all these hidden understandings and things that I learned from that book. And so it did its job. And so it will always forever live on my laptop. Okay. And I call it my practice book. This is the book that I practiced on. But the other thing that came from that was I was writing to trends. I was writing to what I thought that publishing wanted, what I thought people wanted to read. And I had not yet identified who Tara was as a writer. Instead, I was chasing trends. And so it taught me so much about myself. And I said, okay, I'm going to write another book, just because, like I said, when you have a calling to do something, it does not go away. And so I said, okay, but I'm not going to write this next book until everything comes together, and starting with the theme and the story. And it was around the time of the South Carolina church shooting when the parishioners of that church, a Mother Emanuel church, accepted this man. Dylan Roof was the guy, and they accepted him and they welcomed him in and they prayed for him and they fed him, and he shot and killed 9 of them after that. And I remember watching it on TV, and back then school these school shootings, these church shootings, they polarized us because they were not common. Unfortunately, now, you know, we watch it on TV and then we're on to something else the next day because they're so common. But back then, they were not common. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching on CNN that days after that tragic event, that the survivors and their family members, they walked into that courthouse and they forgave him. Yeah. And in that moment, I said to myself, I don't know anything about forgiveness. I know nothing about forgiveness because I grew up in a church. You know, mm-hmm. I went to church on Sundays, Bible study on Wednesdays. And forgiveness was always something that it was preached at us, but it was not anything that we were ever to define for ourselves. We were never told to define what forgiveness means to you. And so I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to write a book about forgiveness and challenge people's definition of forgiveness the way my definition of forgiveness was challenged when they walked in there and forgave him, because I thought there's just no possible way that I could ever be that strong to forgive someone that murdered one of my loved ones. And so I had a theme, and I knew I wanted to write a book about forgiveness, but I did not know the story. I didn't have a story yet. And so I said, okay, I'm going to wait. I have my theme. I'm going to wait. And I was speaking to a dear friend of mine about what happened and the experience that I had about the forgiveness. And she says, well, I have a story for you. And she told me something that I never knew. She told me that she had conceived a child after a sexual assault. And she said these words, and she says, and I practice the act of forgiveness every day. And it just clicked for me that, powerful. Okay, I have a theme, I have a story. And so One Summer in Savannah is that book. One Summer in Savannah tells a story of a woman who conceived a child after a sexual assault and has a very difficult decision to make whether or not to allow her attacker's family into her daughter's life. Yes. And that book, that is One Summer in Savannah. But also while writing that book, mm-hmm. I realized what kind of writer I wanted to be then. You know, I wrote that first book and I was writing to trends. I was writing to what I thought people wanted to read. But I realized, I said, okay, this is what I want to do. Mm. I want to write books that's going to highlight these unknown circumstances and conditions that happen to people every day that we don't talk enough about, or we don't know about it. Let's just be honest, you know, that we don't know about. And so in the middle of that, I've defined, you know, my niche and what the type of writer that I wanted to be. And so, and ever since then, you know, I feel like my writing has just picked up just because I'm writing the books that I want to see on the shelf and yes. not what I think other people want to see on the shelf.
Nice. I love how you stated how your specific niche developed in writing that book. Then you were able to uncover what your niche would be as opposed to what the trends are. So
that's right.
When you wrote your second novel, Long After We Are Gone, you went in a totally different direction, because the first one is about forgiveness and self-discovery after a, you know, a sexual assault that ends in a pregnancy. But this one is a little bit different. Tell me more about Long After We Are Gone.
Okay. So it's different in terms of the theme, but it's the same in terms that it highlights this circumstance that happens to people every day. You know, women are sexually assaulted every day and conceive children from that. We don't talk enough about that. Air property, which is the overarching topic of Long After, is something that when I stand in a room full of people and I ask them to raise their hands, how many people have heard of air property? Almost no one raises their hands, unless, for the most part, it's people that have air property or had a family member that has air property. So the niche, the theme is still the same from what I'm writing. It's about highlighting and fictionalizing these circumstances so people can learn, but also be entertained at the same time. Like, we don't yeah. want to completely just bore people to death. But Long After We're Gone tells the story of four siblings who return home after their father dies. Mm-hmm. And they're all suffering from these demons and their collective struggles. And they have to return home after their father dies to save their ancestral home, the kingdom, and 200 acres of land from being sold out from underneath them without their prior knowledge or consent.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you mention the term air property. For those mm-hmm. of us that don't know that term, could you elaborate more on that? What is air property? What does that mean?
Okay. Air property is a form of land ownership in which descendants inherit interest in the land. It's very similar to, I like to compare it to holding stock in a company. Like you can hold stock in like Apple, but you don't own it, but you have stock in it. So you are a part ownership. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar to holding stock in a company. The problem with that, with air property, is there is no deed, there's no title, no piece of paper that proves ownership of this. Mm-hmm. And so instead of the descendants inheriting a piece of paper or inheriting the title to this deed, they're inheriting just like an interest in the land. And this is how several hundred years ago, this was how land was passed down. And there are so many problems with this. As you can imagine, you know, you need to be able to prove that you own land. And how do you do that? You prove by having a title or a piece of paper or a deed to that. But these descendants do not have that. And so the other problem with heir property is there are, over time, you can have hundreds of heirs to a piece of property because of how it's passed down, because of the interest. Keep in mind the interest. So you have 100% interest is the land, and then you have, let's say, four siblings. You know, you have this, they each inherit 25% interest, but then those siblings have children, so they inherit part of that land. And so now you have all these heirs to, let's just say, 5 acres of land. So you can have 100 heirs to 5 acres of land. That starts to be a problem over multiple generations of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tara, could you also share with us your inspiration for writing this book and highlighting, or better yet, mm-hmm. weaving in the narrative of heir property into the theme of this book? What was your inspiration?
So when I was finishing up writing One Summer in Savannah, I read an article in The New Yorker about these two brothers, Melvin Davis and LaCurtis Reels of North Carolina, who went to jail for 8 years after they refused to leave the land that their great-grandfather had purchased 100 years prior, after it was sold out from underneath them without their knowledge or consent. And that is what really cemented the type of writing that I was going to do, because I said, I'm finishing this book and I need another book, but I need some inspiration. And that was it for me. And I thought, when I was reading this article, I was so angry and frustrated, not only at what happened to them. I mean, they went to jail for 8 years for refusing to leave their own land. And so I thought, what world, you know, how is this even possible? But I was frustrated because I had never even heard of heir property before. It has not even a term I ever heard of before. And most people have heard of eminent domain. Everyone knows what eminent domain is, but no one has heard of heir property, which is just as worse. And so I was frustrated about that. And so I knew that I wanted to write a book that was going to talk about this and highlight this. So in anybody that read this book, when the takeaway is that they've at least heard of heir property before. And so to tie it in, it all goes back to how heir property was first started. And so it goes back to the Reconstruction, because I put my librarian hat on. I'm still working as a librarian when I'm writing this book. And so my question is, when I'm reading about them, I'm like, how is this possible? And then it dawned on me, why are we passing our land down this way? You know, why is there no piece of paper? I was reading the article and I kept saying to myself, where's their deed? Where's their title to hold it up in front of a judge and say, you know, Your Honor, this is our land. Here's our title and deed right here. And then in my research, I realized that they didn't have one. Mm. And so I said, I've got to find out the origins of this, because it doesn't make sense to me. And so it led me all the way back to the Reconstruction, when after the Reconstruction, a lot of formerly enslaved Americans began buying up a lot of land. And the land that they purchased was the undesirable land. Back then, living anything close to water was undesirable because of flooding, because of the heat, because of insects. And so people lived inward because of that. But at this time, these formerly enslaved Americans, this was a lot of land that they could afford. And so they bought the land that they can afford. Mm-hmm. And so this, in the case of the Melvin Davis and the Curtis Reels, this was the same case for them, is that this land that was taken from them was located right next to some water, a nice body of water. It's beautiful land. And so they started buying up this land. And let's be honest, we lived in a different time back then. So at the same time that these formerly enslaved Americans began buying land, you know, people did not want them buying land. And so at the same time, there were laws and policies created to dispossess them of their land. And we're not even going to talk about the violence that went along with that. Yeah. But we're just talking about they went to law and start passing all these laws and policies to dispossess them of their land. So at a time, especially in the South, when a lot of these formerly enslaved Americans could not read or write, they did not trust Southern courts, that they could walk into a Southern court and file a deed and file a will. And so a lot of them just avoided it altogether. And so they said, you know what, we're not going to do this. And they passed their land down via air property. That was the best solution to them at the time. And not understanding and knowing that these same laws that was created all the way after the Reconstruction are still sitting on the books in some states today.
Now, the backdrop of this story is based in North Carolina.
Yes.
And is it similar? Did you get that inspiration from the brothers in regards to, you know, making this book similar to that backdrop as well?
Yes, I did. I was able, because different laws, different states have different laws. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to really carefully follow what happened to the two brothers, Melvin Davis and the Curtis Reels, in my story. So you have the Solomon siblings who also live in North Carolina. And the stories are very similar in terms of what happened to both of them, because I didn't want to have to research different laws in different states. I live in Alabama. Alabama's air property laws are somewhat different than they are in North Carolina. For example, one of those laws is in North Carolina, the two brothers lost their land because of an uncle. An uncle was able to sell some land, even though he was legally entitled to do that, but he was able to sell some land. That's not easy in other states. And so I wanted to use that part of what happened to them in my book as well. And so you can only do that in certain states. In North Carolina, that's still possible. It's an act called the Torrens Act, which allows someone to claim the land for themselves and just claim that they live there, and then land becomes theirs. And that's exactly what happened in that book. I mean, with the two brothers, and it's also what happened in Long After We're Gone.
Okay. Now, Tara, when you say that the land was sold out from under them, what exactly do you mean?
Okay, so what I mean by that is, in the case of, I'll use the book for an example. In the case of the book, King, which is the father, the Solomon siblings, their father, he received a lot of letters from people that were trying to buy his land. And this is something that also happens in real life today. A lot of this same land that was undesirable is now desirable land now. Where the water, nobody wants to live by water. Today, everybody wants to live by water. And so this father, King, he would receive these letters in the mail from people inquiring, trying to buy his land. And so he would send those letters to his daughter, Cece, who was an attorney. So he said, is there anything I need to know about? And the truth is, there was letters in there that he needed to be aware of. But, you know, going to her character, she was just too busy to pay attention to read those letters to tell him. But one of the letters that was received was about this act, that was about that this uncle, or his brother, King's brother, was trying to sell some of this land, and if he contested it, he needed to show up in court to contest it. But because she did not tell him what one of these letters was, he missed a court date, and so they automatically ruled against him and in favor of his brother Shad. Something very similar happened to that in real life with Melvin Davis and the Curtis Reels. It's just a lot of red tape when it comes down to this air property law and how it works. And so they weren't aware of a lot of things that was happening. And so things, when I say that it was sold out from underneath them, they didn't quite understand a lot of what exactly was happening, that it was going to be gone and lost land forever. And so that's what I mean, that it was sold out from underneath them.
Okay. And I know that you said that a lot of states have different laws in regards to air property and how that ownership can be transferred. So is it that in North Carolina, if only one heir sells a property, that it can actually, the entire score of land can be lost? You know, how does that work?
Yes, in North Carolina, what in the book and in what can actually happen is an heir to that land can claim land. So in Long After We're Gone, Uncle Shad, he claimed 5 acres of land of the 200 acres that they had. So he claimed 5 acres for himself and said, this is my land. And he used, like I said, an act in order to do it. It's called the Torrens Act. And the Torrens Act means he's able to just claim that land for himself. And if no one can test it, then it becomes his. And that's exactly what happened. And so, yes, he does not need permission in North Carolina. He did not need permission in order to sell that because he is a legal heir. So he had a legal claim. And if there was going to be any contestation to it, then you go and you contest it and say, no, this is not your land, or you can't contest it. And there's a lot of sticky things that you have to do. You have to claim that you lived there for 5 years or for however many long years. But I kind of, through the book, I kind of just omitted some of that. But basically, that's exactly what happens, is that he claimed 5 acres for himself. And in the book, he claimed 5 acres and he claimed the house. He claimed the land that the house was on. And so they legally owned, they still own the house, but they did not loan the land underneath the house. And so, yes. And that's because they got mixed up with a corporation. And that happens a lot with these heirs. And so you can have, in North Carolina being one of these states, what the corporations will do is, if they want some of that land, they'll start reaching out to out-of-town relatives, out-of-town heirs, and just say, hey, I understand that you are an heir to this property. Will you sell us some of this land? And then most of the heirs will say, well, I have to talk to my family. And then they'll say, no, you don't have to. This is legal. You are an heir. You don't have to speak to any of them. You can just sell us this land. And what happens is they throw a lot of money at them, unfortunately. And they'll say, okay, you know, we'll pay you X amount of dollars for your land. And a lot of them agree to it, not understanding where the land is, you know, or that they should get in contact with their family members, because they feel like, oh, all I'm doing is selling my interest in the land. I'm not selling the actual land. I'm selling my interest. And it's just not true, because these corporations do not reach out and tell them all the legalese that comes along with this, is that there's a lot more to this than what you think it is. So they dangle money in front of them, and they, a lot, unfortunately, a lot of them go for it.
Why do you think this issue is so prevalent for certain classes of people?
It's all because of the money. It's because it, okay, so you have, you say, okay, let's use my personal connection to air property as an example. My mother-in-law inherited, and her siblings inherited, I forget the exact number, so I'll just say 50 acres of land. I want to say it's more than that, but let's just say it's 50 acres of land. She inherited it from her great-grandmother and was told that this has to stay in the family. Mm-hmm. And she, let me go back and tell the story of how she discovered that she even had heir property, because this is why it's happening, because a lot of people don't even know that they have heir property. That's the issue. And so when I first did this research on this book, I went and I was talking to my husband, and I was telling him all about everything that I learned. And he said, you need to go speak to my mom. And I said, why? He said, because our land is heir property. Now, I've been married for just shy of 20 years, and I had no idea that this land was heir property. Now his mother has built a home on this land. His two brothers have built a home. His sister lives here. I knew that they had family land. That's what they call it, family land. But I never knew. No one had ever used the term heir property for me before, and I could not believe it. And so I went and visited her, and she told me this story, and she told me, she said, yes, it was heir property. And she discovered it was heir property because in the 70s, she was at home pregnant with her oldest son, and a man knocked on her door and was inquiring and asking, trying to buy some of the land. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, you know, this land is not for sale. All she ever knew about this land was it was family land, and it had to stay in the family, and they could never sell it. And that was it. And so he's coming to her, and he's talking to her. He's telling her all about this land, that there's a creek that runs by it, that he, how far it goes, the exact acreage of the land, things that she did not even know herself. And so at the end of this conversation, he asked to buy some of the land, and she says, no, I'm sorry. And, you know, again, we live in a different time. This was right after the civil rights, so right during the middle of civil rights in South Alabama. So you can just about to know how intimidating that was for her, for him to say to her, you know, you're going to sell us some of this land. And so she stood her ground and she says, no, I'm not. But it scared her because she realized that she grew up on this land and that she had never in her entire life saw a deed or title or anything dealing with this land. And so what it did was it moved her to action, and she went to go speak to an attorney. And now my mother-in-law, when it goes back to money, she grew up poor. She grew up very poor. They were, and there's a line in the book that says they were land rich but cash poor. And so they have all this land, all their money that they had would be tied to the land, but they did not have the cash. And so she went to go speak to a lawyer, and just, this is another reason why a lot of people are so hesitant to do anything about this air property, because it takes money. Mm-hmm. And so it took her a lawyer. He says, okay, well, I have to look into this. And so he was not, you know, privy on real estate law, which is another issue as far as when we start talking about trying to change it over from air property to deeded property, is a lot of them hit the walls because there's not a lot of real estate attorneys that deals with air property because it's such a complicated issue. And so he did a good job and did the best he could in terms of trying to help her, you know, turn her land over. But it all goes back to money. A lot of times this land, a lot of these are poor Black Americans who have all of this land and don't have the resources to be able to do this, or don't know where to start. It's not even always about the resources. It's just about don't know where to start. Where do I go first? Do I go speak to an attorney first? And then you also have the discord of family. Because now you're going into, let's just sell it, or let's just keep it. And so now you have all these heirs that legally have an opportunity to voice what they want to happen. And so what happens is, and what happens in long after we're gone, is you have conflicting opinions. We should sell it, we should keep it. And so not only do you have the financial burden, you have the familial burden of your family. You're arguing and fighting and discussing who wants to do what with it, because so many people has a say in what happens.
The Hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, how can individuals protect themselves and their family from losing land that has been passed down via air property? How do they protect themselves from that?
It is a long process. Mm-hmm. I think my mother-in-law about 10 years. The first thing we need to do is exactly the reason why I love speaking about air property, is because the more I talk about it, the more people are going to know about it. Yes. And the more people are going to ask people about it and talk about it. And so that's the first thing, is to speak to the elders that are in your family, if you have family land. Because keep in mind, I had been with my husband 20 years. None of them ever mentioned the term air property before. Mm-hmm. So you have to first determine if you have air property. The second thing is go speak to an attorney. Even if this attorney does not specialize in real estate law, yes, go speak to an attorney, because maybe they know someone. Real estate attorneys have, by and large, at least heard of this. They may not be privy on it. They may not be able to be the best person advocate for them, but they have at least heard of air property, and then they can direct them to where they can go. There are now some nonprofit organizations that are popping up that are starting to help people with this. But the most important thing is to don't be stagnated. I speak in front of, this book came out in May, and I've been on the road since May, and I talk to so many people, and they're like, I know I have air property, but we're not doing anything about it. And I just want to cringe because I'm like, please don't, because at the same time, your land is valuable. Even if it's not next to a body of water, it's still your family's land, land that someone worked really hard for. It gets to be complicated. And I was speaking to a woman not too long ago, and she says it's complicated. She has 70, I think she said 70 heirs. And they're divided down the middle. Half of them don't care. You know, a portion of them don't care. A portion of them want to sell it. A portion of them want to keep it. And that's the problem. And then you're just stuck. Then the next part of that is you also have to track down a lot of the heirs. So not only did my grandma, my mother-in-law, she found a real estate. She found an attorney who was able to help her. He was not a designated real estate attorney, but he helped her. The next thing they had to do was track down any heirs. You have to make sure that there's no one else that's living that is legally entitled to this land. Now, she knew that her great-grandmother purchased this land, but she did not know how she purchased it. She and her mother had passed when she was very young. So her mother, her parents were not alive for her to ask, could there be any other children, anybody, any uncles or anyone else out here? And so they had to do a genealogy. They had to go and do genealogy. And in a African American community, genealogy is not easy for us, mm-hmm. because we lose the census. You know, the census only goes up to like 1860, and so it stops after a certain time. So we can't track past that. And so you need to make sure, and then not only for the census that is that you can see, names are misspelled, people are left off, ages are wrong. And so they had to do a genealogy search to make sure that there was no other heirs to this land. And mm-hmm. today in 2024, you can pull up ancestry.com and pull up most of your heirs. But this was in the 70s, and being able to pull up Ancestry and do that was a lot harder than mm-hmm. it is today. And so that's one of the reasons why it took her so long to change over her land, is because they had to make sure that there were no other heirs. The third part of that is you have to survey the land. And if anybody has ever had land surveyed, especially that much land surveyed, it's a long process. Again, me and my husband just got land surveyed because we're building a house. But and so the surveyor, he had this really nice like laser, he was able to laser it down. But guess what? They didn't have that in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It was a long process, and surveying land is not cheap. And so again, my mother-in-law, they were poor. And so everything she had to do, she had to raise the money to do it. She had to raise the money to pay the lawyer, raise the money to pay somebody to do her genealogy, raise the money to have the land surveyed. And so a lot of times, out of all three of those, people stop because they don't have the money, because it's too tiresome, because they just don't know where to go. And then they have no support, especially if you have a family member that says, you know, why are we doing all this? Let's just sell it. You know, it's a long process, but you have to keep pushing through. And so a lot of people just stop because they don't know what to do. And then the fourth part of that is the taxes. There are taxes on, again, imagine taxes on that much land. It's a lot of land. And so again, they had to pay the taxes on that land every year. And this is what gets a lot of people, is the taxes. They allow the taxes to go to the state or go back to the county, and people are losing their land over a couple of $1,000 worth of property taxes. Mm-hmm. And so this woman that I had, the 70, the heirs that I spoke to, she says that they had, I want to say, with a couple of 100 acres of land, nobody wanted to pay the taxes. You know, she was like, I'm having to pay and come up with the money to pay taxes on this land. And so it gets, so after a while, she was about ready to just give up. And someone told her about long after we're gone. And I was so happy that she came, because she said, this gave me the motivation to keep going. And so that's what happens. You have all these factors that just wear you down. And so, but these corporations, they know this. They know that families are divided. They know that there's a lot going on to it. So when you start dangling money in front of people, and it's not just corporations, it's governments too. When you start dangling money in front of people who mm-hmm. don't want to do all the work to this, they take it and they go with it, and they just say, you know what, it's just worth it. But you know, it just depends. And my husband's family, they could not sell the land. They made that promise, but for those that have not, it's just not been an easy process for them.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like they have to
just to recap what you said in regards to the process, the first thing they need to know is, you know, who has the property? What is the family land? Do they have family land? How would they go about searching to find out if they have family land that they're not even aware of?
Oh, that's a very good question. You have to search, especially if in your county. The great thing about today is you can go online. Every county has their county maps available online, and you can search. You can search by last name, first name. That's the first thing you can do, is to see mm-hmm. if there's any land in like a grandfather's name, or because it's going to be, if it's air property, it's going to be a grandfather, a great grandfather name. My mother-in-law, that land was never in her name until she transferred it over. It was in her great grandmother's name, mm-hmm. right? So it's going to be an older person name. So I would check, I would start with my county, the county map, and searching land there. And I would do that. It's not even air property. I would just do that for anyone that has a father or a mother that may be going through dementia or Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Because I spoke to a woman who her father has dementia, and her sister were cleaning out his home, and they were checking his mail, and he had a delinquent tax bill for 10 acres of land that they didn't even know that he had. And they can't ask him about it anymore because he has dementia. And so they ran down to the courthouse to pay that tax bill because they did not want to lose, you know, 10 acres of land, you know, for a couple of $100 in property taxes. But those are the things that this part really speaks to estate planning and speaking to our elders and talking about, you know, what land do we have? Do we have land anywhere? You know, and if we do have land, where is it? You know, and different things like that. And then it also speaks to estranged family members, because I spoke to a woman not too long ago who, this woman, she knew that her father had a sister. She knew she had an aunt, but they were estranged for a really long time. And she knew that the aunt lived on this land that was once in the family. And they received word that the aunt had passed away with a house and 5 acres of land. But because the county did not, they reached out, no one paid it. So they lost that 5 acres of land in that house to the county because she was estranged from her brother. And so that's the things we need to talk about. Do you have any brothers or sisters that we need to be aware of? You know, is there anything? Just, I know these are not easy conversations, mm-hmm. and I know it seems easy, like, oh, just have a conversation. It's not easy to talk to people, especially when there's an estrangement involved. You know, people, especially with older generations, they don't want to talk about things like that. My grandmother, I would ask her about her life in Mississippi, and she didn't want to talk about it. You know, it's just one of those things. And so, you know, that history is lost, and you have to, as much as you can, get them to understand, to make life easy for you later on. You know, tell me not only just your history, but tell me about land that we have. Tell me about, you know, uncles and great uncles and tell me everything that you know, and get as many names as you possibly can, because those names are going to be very helpful. My grandmother, when she passed, in her Bible, that's just how they used to do it back in the day, is that they would put the names in the Bible. That's how they recorded births and stuff, and recorded deaths. They put it in Bibles. And so she had all these names in the Bible. Get that Bible, you know, and ask about some of these people. So mm-hmm. it gets to be really complicated when it becomes really personal and you start getting into like the family dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining that. And I also want to commend you on how you really wove the issue of air property into your novel, because you did a wonderful job of doing that and then bringing awareness to air, the issues with air property. Now, what do you want to accomplish, or what do you hope to accomplish by writing this book?
I want people to know that air property is not a problem that is a historic problem. You know, when I first start telling people about what air property was in the book that I was writing, people thought that this was an historical fiction novel. that it happened, you know, in the 60s or it happens in the 20s. And I said, no, this happens today. This is a contemporary novel because this is a contemporary problem. This is a problem that is still going on today. I don't want people to think that air property is something that, you know, it's not a problem anymore. The majority of the problem has happened, unfortunately. From 1910 to 1997, Black Americans have lost 90% of farmland to air property. You know, the Department of Agriculture has deemed it the worst problem that you've never heard of. Like, you don't, those things don't happen because it's not a major problem. So I want people to understand how much of a problem that is, especially for those who own air property, who have air property or is a legal heir or descendant of someone that has it, to understand that it is a problem. That's the biggest takeaway I want people to know. And then to act. You know, it's more of a call to action. Let's do something about it. Let's stop allowing this land to be lost. You know, if the family voluntarily decides to sell the land, then that's one story. But if for it to be sold out from underneath you, to be taken from you, that's a completely different story, because then there's no financial gain from that. It's just taken from you. And so I want people to act. And like I said, I talk to a lot of people who just are stuck because they don't have the money, because they're fighting with family members. But I say to that, there are people out there that can support you. I don't know off the top of my head some of the nonprofit organizations, but there are nonprofit organizations out there that are helping people with setting them up with real estate attorneys who do specialize in air property. Other nonprofits that are helping people pay taxes on their land, you know, because that's a huge problem. This is another sneak way of people losing their land is by delinquent taxes. And so there's nonprofits out there that's helping people pay their taxes on their land. And so my takeaway is, it's worth it. Someone worked really hard for this land. And when I was asking my mother-in-law, how did your great grandmother purchase this land? And she looked at me and she says, I'll never know. Because she passed away before she could even, her mother passed away before she could even ask her mother. And so that history is lost forever. And so, but she's very proud in the fact that a Black woman, you know, in the early 1900s was able to purchase all of this land. And I would love to know what that story was, because that's a book.
I was about to say that could be your next novel.
that is a book, but that history is completely lost. But she's prideful in that she was able to do something. So that's enough to keep her spirit alive and her wishes alive by not selling this land. And so it's worth it. Someone worked really hard for that land. And so I say, keep going, you know, keep going. There's people out there that can help you and support you.
Beautiful. Well, Tara, what's next for you? You've written, you know, these two wonderful novels, you know, highlighting areas of life that people are not aware of. So what's next for you? What are you working on now? What are your future projects?
I turned in my third book. It's called Where the Wildflowers Grow. Okay. I turned that in a couple of weeks ago. That book comes out in October. Thank you. Thank you so much. It comes out in October 2025. And this book, of course, all of my books are going to highlight this unknown circumstance or condition that happens to people every day. And this book speaks to non-entities. So there's this woman, her name is Lee, and she's born off the grid. And so you have 3 days to report a birth. And when you report a birth, you receive two very important things, a Social Security card and a birth certificate. And so because her birth went unreported, her and her sister's birth went unreported, she does not have a Social Security card or a birth certificate. So technically, she does not exist. And so this book is about identity and finding out who you are. And I was just fascinated when I did a lot of research on the number of people who are fighting to exist. You know, how do you, you know, an 18-year-old woman out of Colorado is fighting to be able to get a driver's license so she can go to college because she does not exist and there's no record of it. How do you prove that you were born? And like I said, like we were talking about, you know, my grandmother reported births in a Bible, but if you don't write it down, you know, there's no evidence of that. And so this book really speaks to identity and who you are and finding it yourself.
Nice. Well, thank you again for joining us today, Tara. It was a pleasure chatting with you as always. And just for the audience, if you haven't gotten a copy of Long After We Are Gone, please run out and get it. And also One Summer in Savannah and the new book coming out in October of next year. You won't be disappointed. Yeah. Thank you so much. And we wish you well in your future endeavors.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Hearing.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed hearing Tara discuss air property and the effects of it, and also getting to know her better. We always are looking for feedback here at The Hearing. So if you have feedback, please email us at thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.